Don't get yourself all worked up.
I'm half Italian and half drag queen. I'm allowed to get worked up.
Still queer as folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Please hit that subscribe button so you don't miss an episode of Still Queer as Folk, and drop us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us.
You can also find us across the social media platforms at Still Queer AF, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This episode is called Brat Sitting. It's number 4 of season 3.
It first aired in the U.S. on March 30th, 2003.
It was directed by Kari Skoglund. We haven't seen her work since season 1, where she directed 2 episodes. It's episode number 5, which was called Now Approaching the Line, and number 6, The Art of Desperation. Those are 2 Dr. David Cameron heavy episodes, so I'm sure that we like those, right, Matt?
I was a big fan.
Kari Skoglund directed 3 episodes of Queer as Folk and went on to direct episodes of House of Cards, The Americans, The Walking Dead, and Boardwalk Empire. 4 very amazing shows.
Now that The Americans has just ended, I think I'm going to make that my next binge show.
It's really, really good. I remember when I first watched season 1, I watched almost all of them in one sitting. It was that good.
Ooh. And I really like Matthew Reese from Brothers and Sisters and Carrie Russell, I mean, obviously. So I'm surprised I didn't get into it, so I'm excited.
It's interesting because Matthew Reese is Welsh, I think.
Yes, yes.
And he does an American voice in all of The Americans, so it's really interesting.
So recommendation for the next podcast, maybe The Americans.
Yeah.
The story for Brat Sitting was by Cowan and Lippman, executive producers of the show. Del Shores wrote the teleplay, his very first episode as a writer. He produced 41 episodes of the show, so about half of the series, and wrote 8 episodes, and this is his first. If you don't know about Del Shores, check out his Sordid Lives series. It's a very campy, gay old time, and they turn it into a movie in the 2000s, and all sorts of great people are in it. You know, Olivia Newton-John, Leslie Jordan that you've seen from Will and Grace, Rue McClanahan from The Golden Girls, Delta Burke. I mean, it kind of feeds into the campy gay boy fantasy.
What's it called again?
Sordid Lives.
Sordid Lives. Another podcast that we can do.
Absolutely.
Here's a recap of Brat Sitting from Queer as Folk, the book.
Melanie and Lindsay choose Michael to be a sperm donor and later broaden the title to father.
Ben is spending more and more time at the gym.
Brian's nephew accuses him of molestation, but Justin saves the day.
Ted asks Emmett to move in, but is quickly overwhelmed by his new boyfriend, and they split.
Until Ted suggests they get a brand new place of their own.
This was a really weird episode.
Absolutely.
It was short, tidy, and really only had an A story with 3 runners. Season 3 is kind of shaping up a lot like season 1 did, where it was kind of all over the place. Season 2 seemed to have a very disciplined A-B runner structure to it. Every episode. I'm not sure where that went in season 3. It's almost like they just started over. And
that's exactly what it is.
They're just throwing stories at us.
Well, I will get into it when we get into the runners, but I was like, we literally saw this entire thing play out in season 1.
Yeah, totally. So the A story is Brian and the Brat.
Oh my God.
This storyline is actually lifted from the UK version as well, which is interesting. You would think that Cohen and Lippman wouldn't have to be recycling stories from the real Queer as Folk series. I probably just ignited a flame war by saying that.
Wow, the real series.
It was the real series.
Okay.
The original.
There you go, the original
series. Yeah, I don't know why they needed to pull this story from there. It was a little bit different, but it was still fundamentally the same thing.
Especially when it wraps up within the episode. It doesn't carry on.
Yeah.
They don't try and branch it off to say like, okay, well, we'll take the core idea, but take it elsewhere. Okay, we'll wrap this up in about 42 minutes.
Exactly. It's great to see Carlo Rota back again as Gardner Vance. Oof, I think he's sexy.
It's his power that makes him sexy. That's what it is.
And his voice.
Well, and that, yeah, and that slight accent.
To eat or not to eat.
Try one.
You know, I'm trying to watch my weight.
One's not going to kill you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, has it been like identified as to what that accent is? I don't want to say it's British. I don't think it is, but it's affected in some way.
Do you mean Carlos says, or Gardner's?
Yes.
I don't think a Gardner is ever really identified.
Yes, and I love that those bag of chips are apparently insanely hot.
Yeah, they sound
good, actually.
Brian's sister Claire is back. We haven't seen her since season 2, episode 9, Accentuate the Positive. We also never see her again.
Fine by me. She just like barges her way in.
I don't care what he's doing. I have to see him.
I'm sorry, Brian. She insisted. Brian, I need to talk to you. The school just called. Peter broke his arm at soccer practice.
She and Brian clearly don't have this kind of relationship to say that she feels comfortable. I don't think it's really about her comfort. She just wants to barge in, say, I need you to watch my son. Be useful for once. Bye. Like, what? she's just such an over-the-top character. And they, at first I thought it was just going to be like the thing when it was Jack's funeral and they were talking about how she's sort of milking the moment. But then I realized like, I think they just wrote her to be some hysterical.
She's an hysterical woman.
Yes. And I'm like, this is just isn't fair. I mean, you sort of spend more time developing the lesbians and Debbie. And so all the other women just kind of get shafted.
Claire Kinney was played by Kirsten Kieferl, who also appeared in, wait for it, 3 episodes of Degrassi, Yay. The Next Generation, as Mrs. Nash. I don't know who that was.
Well, she was in 3 episodes. There must have been some storyline. We'll have to go back and watch.
So Claire just dumps John on Brian, but that kid is like 14 years old. He can't just go home and sit there as like a latchkey kid.
Well, clearly he's also such a little prick.
You still a fag?
Yeah. But that's the thing. He goes to the arcade that one time.
By himself.
Yeah. So
he goes after school. Is she saying that like, I have to be at the hospital overnight? In which point, take the kid with you. I mean, you're going to have to.
Just send him home. He'll be fine.
Now, he totally would have been the kind of kid that would try to break into like the liquor cabinet split, you know, a bourbon with his grandma.
So this was a curious storyline. The brat, John Kinney, we're assuming that his last name is Kinney. Maybe Claire was married. I don't know. Where'd these kids come from?
She sounds like the kind of woman who was married and then it got divorced.
Who's Brian's brother-in-law?
He probably fucked him. That would have been interesting.
So the brat, I thought, was kind of used to show Michael as a good future father figure and also to create a problem for Brian. So this kid was versatile. He had 2 roles. Not like that.
I'm sorry.
He had to be a youth that Melanie and Lindsay could see him interacting with and being like dad material, even though the kid's like 14.
Well, and here's the thing. I don't think he was being dad material. I think he was just looking at someone who was on his level. Sorry, Michael. I think you just related to him a little too close.
This is a little weird scene at Brian's loft where John's exploring. He finds VHS porn tapes.
Yeah.
A drawer full of dildos and toys. But does Brian even use those? Brian uses his dick. He doesn't need toys, right?
Unless the cop is providing his nightstick. Usually he doesn't get anything else in the way. He just sort of has those. And then it made me wonder, what exactly are the rules when it comes to having a kid who is under the age of 18 handling said dildo, anal beads?
Well, Brian was in the shower.
No, I'm talking about like from a production perspective.
Oh, the actor.
Yes. Oh. What are the rules of allowing people of that age to handle?
Usually there's a counseling session that accompanies the tough adult work. You know, like if a kid's in a horror movie or is acting out like a really grotesque story or something like that, they have counselors that work with the young man.
So if you have any questions about what this is and how it is used, please speak to the counselor on set.
Well, usually it's a required session from their union, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. But what was this leather harness doing in Brian's loft, too? Brian doesn't wear leather.
Was it a harness? I thought it was some sort of like...
I just saw straps.
Gag.
Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was.
I saw wide leather straps.
Oh, then maybe it was a harness or some sort of leather jock strap.
But that's not what Brian wears.
Who said it was his?
Why would he have it? For a guest?
I mean, people leave things all the time.
That's true. I've got a whole collection of things that have been left behind. So John kind of pokes around, steals some money from Brian. Brian sort of overreacted just a bit and grabbed the kid, dragged him around, and then stuck his head in the toilet.
That will teach you to fuck with faggots.
You're going to be sorry. You're going to be so sorry.
What?
Now that's the problem. Really, the kid could have gotten him for that shit.
Right, exactly.
He'd been like, hi, you just threw my head in a toilet. That's kind of abusive.
It's like, calm down, Brian. It's like, jeez.
Don't get me wrong. This kid is a little fucker. But I feel like that is definitely some sort of abuse to give him a swirly like that.
That same scene appeared in the UK edition where Stuart Alan Jones put his nephew into the toilet. Only I thought Stuart handled it a little bit better. It was more of a kind of hold the kid by the legs and dunk him a few times.
Oh, yeah. Now here he was like shoving his head down.
Yeah, we get the point of view shot where we see him. I did kind of like that. It's like, yeah, get that little fucker.
It was, yeah. And then he comes up with this, you'll be so sorry. I'm like, what?
I'm not a big fan of children. So I like it when a child gets
their come up first. Well, especially when it's a kid who's such a little shit.
Mm-hmm. So Brian, I don't know where he went, but he's coming back and he just can't wait to fuck this guy. So he starts fucking him in the elevator. If you watch closely, he just shoved it right in. There was like no condom, no lube.
Yeah.
Shoves it right into that mover's butt.
Yeah.
In the elevator. Bam.
I was like, I know.
It's great.
I know Brian has always perpetuated the idea of safer sex. In no way did we ever see any moment of him tearing open a condom with his teeth.
Or throwing it up into the air.
Or anything. He just hocked it up and stuck it in.
What did you think of Carl all of a sudden appearing as police? You know, we have Melanie who's lawyer. Now we have Carl who's police. So he, of course, has to run over to break the news to Debbie.
There's something I thought you should know. One of your lost boys is in trouble.
Which one?
Kinney.
Brian? Something happened to Brian?
It seems his 12-year-old nephew has accused him of molesting him.
I just thought that was a little strange. Like, this is a big police department, so he's got to run over there and be the archangel of Brian. Attention, everyone. He has been arrested. Or, I'm sorry, detained.
Detained.
Vic is the prescient one who says, has he been arrested? Like, Vic knows all the steps involved with this.
Well, yeah, because Vic himself has been arrested.
Exactly. And what a coincidence, though, that Justin just happens to be at Debbie for the first time in ages. Did you notice that Debbie and Carl are calling each other honey?
It takes one night of passion. Now they're very comfortable with each other. So good for Debbie. Again, I'm into it.
It wasn't even full passion. She just blew him.
Apparently very well. So, and I am assuming based on how the last episode ended, he returned the favor.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Forgot about that. So Horvath calls Brian one of Debbie's lost boys.
Which I thought was funny.
Well, where did that come from?
I personally think he's referencing Peter Pan and the Lost Boys.
I don't know what that is.
You know, the boy who never grew up.
Why would Carl know that?
What? Peter Pan is a pretty well-known story, Patrick.
But why would he equate that to Brian? Describe Peter Pan for me. I do not get this analogy at all.
Okay, so the J.M. Barrie story, Peter Pan, is about the boy who would never grow up. So he stays in Neverland so he doesn't ever have to grow up. And he has a group of kids who are the lost boys, basically orphans, that also stay in Neverland. And so he's the leader of the lost boys. And then when Wendy comes to Neverland, she acts as the mother of the group because they've never really had a mother.
Okay.
If that helps.
That makes total sense.
Okay.
Why didn't you say that?
Well, you asked me to explain it and there I got there.
You're like, it's Peter Pan.
I guess in my mind, I figured everybody knows Peter Pan.
This was quite a stretch for Horvath, though.
I think I've given you all I could give. Well, I guess we'll have to just... I'm wondering now if this is going to show up as one of your misses.
we'll see.
Are you editing at this moment? Lost Boys.
I think the miss is you refusing to explain it to me. You're just like, no.
I wasn't saying no.
I'm not going to tell you.
I was just like, how far back do I have to go?
I could not tell you the Peter Pan story.
Oh, okay.
All I know is that Robin Williams played Peter Pan. It had to have been like the hairiest Peter Pan ever.
Well, that was a variation of Peter Pan, but yes.
So the show took a somewhat dated preachy turn when Brian starts to make it a hetero versus homo thing.
Listen up, Michael. Are you listening?
I'm listening.
They're heterosexuals. They think all us perverts are after only one thing, to get our hands on some sweet piece of little boy meat.
So all he has to do is accuse you and they automatically believe him?
But now I have to use the money I was going to spend on my Botox treatment to some goddamn $300 an hour lawyer.
Well, this has always been Brian's stance, as it were.
We haven't heard it in a while, though. And here it was full bore.
Oh, I feel like we've heard it enough to equate it that this is how Brian feels. Because I feel like he said it a lot. I feel like, well, of course he's going to say that. We heard it recently near the end of the second season when Lindsay's trying to discern how Brian feels about Justin and they're in the park and then he sees the heterosexual couples and he's arguing that that's not what being gay is about. So that's what I'm thinking of.
Did it have anything to do with Peter Pan?
No, but Peter Pan can be pretty queer too.
Or maybe Winnie the Pooh. Oh, and Brian was going to get Botox too. That's what he announces to Michael on the sidewalk of the police station. That's new.
Oh, okay. I had nothing to say when he mentioned it. I was like, you're 30 and you still look youthful-ish.
Yeah, I felt like that line was a little bit of a harbinger of things to come with Brian. He begins to age and his body is no longer the tight, young, virile hunk that we were introduced to when he was 29. So
I don't think it's that tight to begin with, but that's just me.
So I think this might have been a bit of a first seedling germinating about that theme that's going to come back across the entire year. This is also the only mention of Michael's drag queen father.
Don't get yourself all worked up.
I'm half Italian and half drag queen. I'm allowed to get worked up.
Pretty sure that we never hear reference to Michael's father ever again.
Which is a
shame. Great story device, people.
It's always like it was a test. Like, do you remember your continuity?
Yeah.
Have you been paying attention?
It almost feels like the entire crew was rotated to begin series three. So like Tanya Lemke, our favorite prop supervisor, she's not on this series.
Oh.
There's new writers. There's new directors. They just kind of rotated out a whole bunch of people that were really holding the show together.
Which is a shame. You know, I think we talked about this before we started recording, is that it feels like it's a... Like season three is its own reboot.
But with better hair. I thought this whole arc of Brian, his mother, his sister was just a bit too melodramatic.
Oh my gosh. Like his mother, like that, yeah, that scene when he wants to confront the kid and.
Yeah, it's what his mother was waiting for. And his sister just seemed to pile onto it. So
You're a sick pervert. And I'm like, to be honest, you've known Brian for much longer than your son. And have you not noticed that your son's a little shit and a total homophobe, which no doubt had been filtered in by said grandmother and mother? It was so uncomfortable to the point where I was having trouble buying the drama. It felt so manufactured. Now that Jack's dead, his mother is in full
booze mode.
Insane. Homophobic, I'm sure she wouldn't mind a queer bash kind of level. It was very strange.
She did have a drink with her when Brian came over.
Oh, yes. And I'm glad he read her for that.
So, of course, Brian heads directly to Babylon after that encounter.
Clearly.
Where else would you go after you were arrested for allegedly fondling your nephew and you get out?
Oh, it definitely wasn't just fondling. They were saying his nephew was arguing that he tried to make him suck his dick.
Ugh.
And I was like, that is far.
So where else to go but Babylon after going to your mother's house, yelling at them. And
trying to get Babylon. Your dick sucked. Yeah.
Did it look like Babylon was much less crowded that night?
Yes, it seemed like it was like a Tuesday or something.
This might have been the moment where the show built their own Babylon. So initially it was a location every time. And at some point in the series, they built it on a soundstage.
Yes, because I noticed that the layout of Babylon changed for me. Because I think it was in the episode with Dijon, like the mustard, that the bathroom, you used to have to go downstairs and it was sort of like at a basement level. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here they were just on the first floor when Emmett went to the bathroom.
So Brian eventually finds a trick, and the trick is a younger looking gentleman.
You're a little young for me.
That's not what I heard.
That had to have been about Justin though, right? Not about John?
No, that had to be about John.
How did all of Babylon find out about this?
Well, clearly everyone knows who Brian Kenny is, because we see so many times people say, oh, that's Brian Kenny. And people will talk.
But he was literally just arrested that night. How did that get to Babylon so quickly?
Gay culture, man. We gossip like fuckers.
Activate the phone tree.
Otherwise, it was just a simple, easy line for the writers to throw in there to make him feel uncomfortable. Because of what's going on with his nephew, you immediately attribute that moment to the situation with his nephew, not Justin.
Well, that was my next comment about that line, is it just seemed forced.
Oh, like, absolutely.
Oh, how convenient.
Yes. Let's make sure that he feels uncomfortable people do know what happened.
So Justin immediately comes to the rescue.
And goes to the arcade, which I don't know how he knew which arcade his nephew would be in.
That arcade immediately dated the show.
Well, I mean, there are arcades still around.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Where?
The suburbs.
Oh, I guess.
Well, and downtown, because if you go to like For the Win downtown.
If we go to Replay.
Or Replay. Replay is very vintage, but we're talking like arcade. Like Dave and Buster's level arcade. But this is that sort of, this would be at a strip mall kind of level. Yeah.
Did Justin think that he could reason with that little shithead or something? What was his intention when he went to round him up?
I mean, he's only a couple of years older than him. So he probably figured
5 years at least.
It's closer than anybody else on the show.
I mean, what did he think he could do?
Somehow, Justin has always proven himself to be very savvy when having to fix problems like this.
Well, this was like superpower level stuff.
Well, he's always been the fixer. It's very interesting.
Except when he got hit over the head, of course. But I just thought it was strange that he's going to go track this kid down and like collect evidence on him without really knowing like what kind of evidence he was going for.
Right.
What the fuck are you doing? Get your hands off me.
It's a cool bracelet.
And apparently seeing Brian's bracelet was enough for Justin to organize the rescue party with Horvath and Debbie.
Yes, he gathered the troops like no tomorrow. He made sure that he could somehow get in the house with Brian's sister. Mm-hmm. And somehow know that the kid's going to come home and not be tipped off that he's been found out in any way.
Very
impressive.
You got the troop together really quickly.
Yes.
Why was Brian's cowrie shell bracelet at all exculpatory, though? It's like, oh, John, you have the bracelet. You lied. The two aren't connected, though. He lied about where he got the bracelet, but that doesn't mean that Uncle Brian tried to shove his dick in his mouth. This all just came together a little too neatly. Like, Justin sees the bracelet at the arcade. They get to the house.
Thus, he is a liar.
Yeah, so this was just really, really weak writing.
Thus, he is a liar, and his mother will demand that he tell him the truth, and that is that. It's what?
Yeah.
What just happened?
He just stitches it up right away. The only thing I liked about this scene is that Horvath flashed his badge.
Detective Carl Horvath, Pittsburgh PD.
Normally we don't see Horvath like doing cop shit anymore.
But I also love once he's been found out, and I have to talk about how John runs up the stairs.
Oh, well, I didn't notice.
It was just so strange the way he did it. I was like, so that's how you're going to run to your room. Honestly, they should be trying to like arrest you for lying to the police. I mean, that's filing a false report.
I don't think he lied to the police though, did he?
Yes, he did. He said that Brian did this stuff to him.
He told his mom and grandma, right?
That's filing a false report.
Well, they filed the report, not John Kinney.
You're getting caught up in the technicalities of it.
I'm trying to like add something to this really, really weak writing.
I think you can add all you want. It's still going to
still end be weak writing. It was nice of Justin to pocket the bracelet, took the evidence, and return it to
right
to Brian.
Shouldn't you be getting back to your boyfriend? Yeah.
I give Justin some props there for walking away from Brian's sort of semi-seductive moment.
Oh, yes. I want to know how many of our listeners thought, in that moment, is Justin going to
bend over,
succumb to what I thought were very clear advances?
Yeah, it was a nice touch that Brian left the door open. He might change his mind. He walks across the loft and we see him turn back to see if Justin had come in. It's really nice directing for such a weak story.
They allowed Vic's arrest to carry on for multiple episodes. They weren't going to do anything with this.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. Lindsay are looking for a load to
good Lord.
Shoot up Melanie. So
I was like, how you're trying to make this as dirty as possible, aren't you? How far are you gonna go?
Nah, that's as far. So they Melanie is having the dream of the sperm donor pageant.
And the winner is Brian Kinney!
This was the opening scene of the episode. I like that. I thought that was kind of cute. And
I wanted it to be a little more specific. I would have loved to have seen a top three, or at least see like have them have a whole conversation about a first runner up or something. I thought that would have been really funny.
Did you notice this cute little moment where we see Emmett and Justin holding hands like as the winner is being announced?
Oh my gosh, I missed that.
Just like, you know, a beauty pageant where
yes, like, oh, we're so like, supportive of each other.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope you get it. I hope you get it. That's funny. That's a good detail. I may need to go back and just to catch that.
I like this runner here. The little pageant was funny. I liked it. It was campy, but neat. I liked it.
Yes. I love that then the next scene they're trying to work through list the possibilities because again, Melanie has put her foot down and that nothing that comes out of Brian's penis will be entering her.
There's an interesting little moment where we first get a glimpse that she is not at all down with that. That's where she gets up from bed after she wakes up and closes the window. Carrie Skoglund cut to a shot outside of their house looking up at the brick with the rain and the lightning. I thought it was really nice. It was just a really quick exterior.
But a very specific one.
I don't think it meant that much, but it was a nice stylistic piece in the show because normally in a soundstage show, the exteriors are rare. I don't even know if this was a real exterior, but I really like that waking up in the middle of the night, it's raining, it's thunderstorming. You get up, you close the window. You're like, oh, a storm. Then you go back to bed.
Right.
So I like that. Doesn't Ted seem like the perfect sperm donor, though?
I mean, I would think so.
Why wouldn't Melanie have gone directly to him? Because they're like BFFs, right?
Right. Like we even saw them like have lunch together. They went shopping together. They were having, I thought that made the most sense out of everybody.
Yeah, totally.
But then they had like a no moment. And then I was so surprised.
But he would have been perfect.
Yeah. And I'm like, they land on Michael?
Well, yeah, I had an issue with the way that they dropped this bomb on him. He's just sitting there talking to Gus and they say, and we'd like you to be the father.
Yeah, they were kind of buttering him up, saying how wonderful he is with Gus. And somehow because he managed to tame the little prick.
Yeah,
it's which like I'm like
Mike and Dad mode.
He didn't win. He bought his love. He gave him a bunch of free comics. So of course the kid's gonna like him. I will say something I really really liked. You know, you were speaking about that exterior shot. This edit that happened where he's just been given the news that they'd like him to be the father, and then it cuts to him being in his room with Ben having just heard the news. I thought that was pretty neat.
Ben's mouth is agape. He's like,
they want you to do a what?
Then that scene turned into a very hot fuck in the shower. one per episode, I guess, is the rule now.
Yes. Can we talk about the design of that bathroom?
I noticed that too. That arch.
That arch. It, like, the shower is built in this arch,
like,
but the
that.
Tub is it really just a tub that, like, has a, like, an alcove or what? I couldn't figure it out because the shower curtain was going all the way around. It seemed.
I believe it was a clawfoot tub.
Okay.
Under the arch with a curtain that does go all the way around.
Okay.
Just my
very
guess.
Strange. It's a very strange way to build a bathroom in that apartment.
Yeah. They get it on in there. So that and, was
well,
cute.
Right. Well, that's because there was that moment where the steroid vial fell out of Ben's, mm-hmm. you know, clothes. So he quickly covered that up. And that, I don't know if him possibly almost getting caught is what made him so lusty towards he's like, I need to distract him. I'll fuck him in the shower.
Melanie goes, law on Michael after Michael learns the difference between sperm donor and father.
Okay. Then all you have to do is sign this.
The donor agrees. No parental rights. Visitation strictly by permission. What's all this?
I thought this was a pretty reasonable tie-in back to Brian, not immediately signing over his parental rights to the Dykes. That arc spanned half of season one.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a nice kind of callback to that.
Well, now, wasn't Michael privy to the drama that happened with all of that?
Yeah, of course.
So then you would think, I guess...
Which is why he got upset.
Well, and to me, I would have been like, you didn't learn anything from that moment, from that whole thing, that maybe this is what they were going to land on you, or understanding their position as well. I guess it seemed to me that he thought he was going to be the father the way Brian is kind of the father.
Oh, well, figure. He did. And that's why he was upset about it. And that's why he walked out of the
boulangerie. I think the lesbian's terms were very reasonable because, again, that allows them to be involved in the child's life. Just means the lesbians are going to be around. Why is that so bad?
Yeah, I think once he saw the legalese of it, that's where he started to realize that he would have literally no involvement, no rights. So that's what I believe really set him up there.
I can buy that.
Michael, about the agreement.
Look, I already told you.
We know. That's why we decided to amend some of the fine points. Provided you fulfill your function, you will herewith be referred to as the father.
So when they tear up the agreement, she makes what we later find out to be a major legal malfunction, which is they don't have this agreement, but as we find out later in the series, they really needed to have this agreement.
Oh, so no.
Melanie is, once again, a terrible lawyer.
Maybe this is why they're always strapped for cash. You know, she doesn't win much.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, getting rid of that document really, really sets the stage for a gigantic story arc coming up. So she blew it once again.
Ugh.
Just like when she could have had millions for Emmett, but no. She didn't. She blew that one.
That was Emmett's choice. I'm not going to blame that one on Mel.
She could have negotiated harder.
Still queer as folk.
So Ted and Emmett here.
Ooh.
I thought this was an interesting contrast between Justin and Ethan that immediately moved in together. And yet both Emmett and Ted and Michael and Ben make such a big deal out of moving in with each other. And even Vic kind of weighed in on it about... It's not easy for men to live together. So it was a funny contrast that Justin and Ethan, they move in, they make it work, they're pretty together, perfect.
I found this to be such, first of all, they're moving in after what, 3 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in my mind, as they're having like their dinner and we see how Ted like has to make sure the place is spotless before they do anything else, immediately my head went into Sondheim's Company and I heard You Could Drive a Person Crazy in my head. And
it's a little bit of a throwback to season one when the guys are looking down the stairs at the movers, but Emmett has so much stuff that he needs movers. He had like 4 movers and tons and tons and tons of stuff, but he's moving all this into Ted's little apartment.
Yeah, that didn't make much sense why they needed so many movers. But also, this is such a recycled storyline from season one. It follows almost to the T Michael and Dr. David Cameron's first moments of living together. When Michael dumps all of his stuff in Dr. David Cameron's how did you describe it? Mid-century?
Architecturally really perfect mid-century modern home.
Yes. And so that when we see Emmett trying to make his home comfortable for him now, because he lives there as well, and he's trying to cook Ted dinner, Ted flips his shit. Emmett is everywhere.
Well, I think Emmett can come over and cook for me anytime and do all that. This was some nice set dressing because the moment Ted comes home from work, the clock accurately said 5:40 p.m. Nice touch. And Emmett's belongings were draped everywhere, including his undies in the bathroom, which I don't think Emmett wears those undies, that style of undies.
No, they looked like, because they were still on that plastic clips that you would find at like a store. I was like, did he just shoplift those from the store he worked at? What's going on here?
The scene was just way too predictable.
Yes, because again, we saw it in season one.
Like, it's just a really old issue that happens all the time when people move in with each other.
And then there's the whole Pavarotti's nail.
That's actually real.
That's fine that it's real, but the fact when Ted says that everybody knows that, I was like, really, Ted? Everybody knows that Pavarotti took a nail from every place. Really? This is your Peter Pan. This is what this is.
My Peter Pan?
I had assumed you knew the Peter Pan story. This is your Pavarotti's nail with Peter Pan.
Well, if you are at all into opera, well, okay.
Yeah. And we know that Emmett is decidedly not. So Ted was being a little snobbish, I thought.
I've never been entirely comfortable with like sort of the Emmett treatment. So when I have guests over for longer periods of time, I never really like that much junk scattered around. So I usually find a good balance between like the communal living space and then like my set aside workspace.
So nice. I just
set the ground rules in advance. It's like this area here, stay out. You may
do not enter.
You may take a walk through it, but you may not bring goods into it. You may not linger, trespass. Well, you can trespass. You may not loiter in this space. Oh my gosh, their solution is to buy a house.
Right. My house doesn't work for you. Your house doesn't work for me.
They just started dating.
Let us buy property together.
So I suggest we take Dear Ab's advice and get our place. A space big enough for you to feng shui your heart out and for me to close the door and try and hit a high C along with Pavarotti if I want to. In fact, I was thinking of a house.
Oh, that's so smart, Ted. That's like a great idea.
I like that Ted's kind of all in on this and he's going for it.
He's stunningly optimistic about this.
He's a man with a plan.
Sure.
So speaking of men with plans, Ben and his roid rage. So Ben's just wandering around Michael's comic store erect. Remember that when he stops by to see Michael? And Michael gives him a hug and a kiss, and he's like, oh, you're hard. So he's just like wandering around the comic store with a boner.
You were great with him. You know that?
Kids love me. Don't ask me why.
I don't have to.
God, you're hard.
Yeah, you too.
I thought he was talking about his body, like his muscles, because then the next line is about him talking about his muscles. I don't think it was talking. Yeah, I don't think it was talking about his penis. He was talking about his body. His body is hard. It's a hard body.
Well, yeah, because then he blew off date night to go work out, so maybe he did have a hard body, not a hard on.
Right.
I like that scene in the diner when Vic just chases Ben down the street for no apparent reason.
No, oh no, he had a perfect reason. This is something that I love about Vic, is I think he's incredibly perceptive. He knows that Ben is off, and the fact that he's going to the gym, because he points out that clearly he is trying to compensate for something because lover dies and he is trying to be at the gym so much to prove something. Like, he knows that he is not handling what happened with his former lover well.
How does Vic know all this, though?
Because Vic was on the verge of death as well.
No, how did he know about Ben's problem with Paul dying and things like that? All of a sudden, Vic knows things that he really wouldn't have a reason to know.
You don't think Michael would have shared that? To say, like, Ben is going through this tough time because his lover died. And plus, this is something that Vic has also experienced.
Well, maybe Michael is encountering Vic more often than we realize.
Right. Because remember, we didn't even see Vic in the last episode when the news broke. So we could assume that in a bridge that happens between the two episodes, that Michael and maybe Ben was there when he shared the information, and or something to that effect.
Well, it seemed like Vic's first thing was leading off with maybe Ben's disappointed about Michael having a child and Ben cannot have the child. Maybe that led into the rest of it. Maybe he had good Spidey sense there. Sure.
But yeah, again, this is something that I really, really love about Vic as a character now. In the first season, he was very, woe is me, I'm dying kind of character. But when they decide, oh, you know, he actually works in the series, let's make sure we keep him around. I feel like they found a really interesting balance of saying like, oh, he's going to be the grounded one. The one who's not fucking insane because he's lived through this. Yeah. And he's going to be the sage, wise one. And I really like that.
I would have liked to have seen Vic on steroids.
Oh, God.
Just like all pumped up. This scene seemed really mostly just designed to give Ben like yet another reason to keep being a juice pig. That's what steroid uses
are called. I was like, what? I know what a suck pig is.
That's Ted. All right, so let's recap this episode.
Yes.
Hits and misses. My hit was Ted coming home to Emmett, having redecorated the entire apartment and touched all of Ted's special things. I can absolutely relate to how Ted felt, and that's happened to me more than once, so this scene really resonated with me.
My hit was, as I just spoke of it, Vic. I love the fact that Vic came in, understood that he was reading between the lines. It felt realistic to me. I love that Vic is the one who has the perception to understand and read between the lines and try and be there for these characters. Kind of like the way Debbie is, but in a more realistic fashion. He's not over the top with it. And he always usually gets a good one-liner in.
Yeah, there's usually good writing for Vic.
I'm all good for dialogue. A Vic spinoff.
So my big miss here was Brian's little big problem that was solved just way too quickly. Mm-hmm. This arc easily could have spanned multiple episodes, but like all things Queer as Folk, it's fixed by the end of the episode. And I thought that was a big miss in the writing.
Just to switch it up, because I am very much in agreement with your miss, I'm going to put my miss as your hit. Just recycling the Michael Dr. David Cameron line for Ted and Emmett, because it followed it so closely and didn't really provide us anything new. It's like, then why do I even care if they try to move in together? Like, what would have happened if they made it work somehow?
Maybe I liked Emmett's redecorating better than Michael's when he moved in with Dr. David.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, what if adding a little messiness, quote unquote, to Ted's life makes him love Emmett even more? And like, what if their sort of opposite tendencies somehow clicked? I would have been much more interested in that. And then to say that they're like, well, to solve it, let's just buy a brand new place together. Let's just start fresh together. Just did not work.
Buy Dr. David's place.
Yes.
That at least should be up by now, right? This has been episode 4 of season 3, Brat Sitting. Next time, Debbie and Vic rally support against Police Chief Stockwell's bid for mayor and his conservative platform.
Despite that, Brian decides to work on his election campaign.
That starts to get a little interesting next episode. That will be episode 5 of season 3, and it's called There's Nothing Noble About Being Poor. Thanks for listening. Please rate or review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us, and subscribe. It really does mean a lot to us and helps a lot of people find our show.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can also like us on Facebook at StillQueersFolk.
And of course, if you want to connect with us personally, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall with no E's.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
See you next week. Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.